The longest bus strike in Tucson's recent history is over, more than 40 days after it started. But the damage is done.
I talked to bus riders who lost jobs or people who were looking for jobs and had to change their job search because they could only look on the routes that were running.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, less than half of Arizona's high school grads are eligible for the state's universities. Conservationists and the military work together on habitat protection.
What Phoenix might look like without water.
And tryouts for a well-known song.
It'd be a great opportunity to be able to sing in front of a lot of people.
Oh, say, can you see?
Plus, a trip to obedience school, and we play the quiz.
That and more on the show, after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. Valley weather for the rest of the day. It'll stay sunny, and we're looking for a high temperature of 98. Clear skies, dry tonight with lows in the mid to upper 70s. Sunny skies for tomorrow. Back to the century mark with a high around 101. Currently, relative humidity is at 23%. We have clear skies and 93 degrees.
An Arizona State University professor is on administrative leave over allegations of plagiarism. School officials say he's been relieved of all duties. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports.
Dr. Matthew Whitaker has been accused of using PowerPoint slides from the Chicago Police Department while consulting for the Phoenix Department. And a recent academic review highlighted significant issues with his book on Black America. ASU spokesman Mark Johnson said the school is reviewing allegations that, quote, his conduct has fallen short of the university's expectations for a faculty member and scholar. His attorney, Lonnie Williams Jr., says the issues with the city of Phoenix have no bearing on Whitaker's ability to teach. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A former state employee who oversaw purchasing at Arizona's Medicaid program has pleaded not guilty to charges that he stole at least $1.5 million from the program. Maricopa County Superior Court officials say 63-year-old Michael Veit of Phoenix entered his plea today. A co-defendant, 67-year-old Michael Joseph Cameron, also pleaded not guilty today. Veit and Cameron face numerous counts of crimes, including conspiracy, money laundering, trafficking in stolen property, and theft. The Arizona Attorney General's office launched a criminal investigation after an inspector general investigation found what appeared to be improper business practices at the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System.
Tucson's bus strike is over 42 days after it started. Drivers, mechanics, and other members of Teamsters Local 104 voted to accept a new contract from the operator of SunTran, the city's bus system. Reporter Andrea Kelly covers local government for Arizona Public Media in Tucson. And Andrea, what led to the end of the strike?
That's an interesting question because we don't actually have the full answer to that. We don't know what the terms were for the deal that the Teamsters agreed to last night and that SunTran offered yesterday. What we do know is that last week, the Tucson City Council told the SunTran management company that it wanted that company to put in all the money that it has saved with the strike by not running full bus routes, not paying all the employees because they've been out on strike, take that money that's been saved and use it in these negotiations as some extra money to give some more raises. So we know the city council said to do that last week, but we do not know the terms of the deal that was struck last night because neither side is talking about what exactly the agreement came to.
Why not?
Well, we know that the Teamsters are saying they don't want to make people who are already upset about the strike more upset by knowing the details. We do know that the Teamsters were asking for higher wage increases than SunTran was initially willing to give. We also know that raises were a part of this deal, but we don't know any more information about that.
If the company is just taking money that it saved during the strike and putting it toward raises, isn't that just money that the workers would have gotten anyway had they not gone on strike?
Well, that's certainly one way to put it. And another way to look at it is that if that money is bolstering the wages that are going to be paid for the rest of this fiscal year, what happens next year when there's not any extra money lying around because there hasn't been a strike? So some city council members are saying this is really just not actually a long-term solution. It's just a way out of this present strike so the buses can run again right now and that there's going to be more trouble coming up long-term. They're also hinting at problems potentially coming up with another part of this contract. This strike was just bus drivers and mechanics and fuel operators, but the paratransit system known as SunVan here that picks up people who have designated handicapped disabilities, that separate piece of the contract is coming up for renewal soon and may also face some difficult negotiations.
What has the impact of this 42-day strike been on the city, on residents, on people who rely on bus service?
Just by the numbers, we know that about 66,000 people typically rode the buses on a typical weekday, and that during the strike, those numbers were as low as 10,000, 15,000, because the limited bus service that the company was able to offer during the strike. Beyond that, I talked to bus riders who lost jobs or people who were looking for jobs and had to change their job search because they could only look on the routes that were running. So people were rearranging their lives in order to do this. Of course, the bus drivers who were on strike got paid less. The city, we're in the middle of an election cycle. This November, there are 3 city council members and the mayor up for re-election and 3 Republican challengers against those Democratic city council members. And all the time, we were asking people in interviews, what is this going to mean at the ballot box? And of course, that'll not be clear until November.
Does this seem to be at least an issue that candidates and incumbents are talking about?
Absolutely. I would say at this point, this is the biggest issue in the city council races. This has been a big impact for people. Even those who don't ride the buses have employees or employers who rely on the bus system. The U of A campus where I work is served by dozens of bus routes, and students and faculty and employees ride buses here, whether it's out of convenience or out of necessity. This system is critical to the city, so this has been a big issue.
Andrea Kelly is a reporter for Arizona Public Media in Tucson covering local government. Andrea, thank you.
Thank you.
A newly released study from the Arizona Board of Regents finds less than half of the state's high school graduates can get into its public universities. The research found 46.5% of Arizona high schoolers were eligible for admission. That's pretty close to the number the last time this study was done in 2009. Joining me to talk about this is Eileen Klein, president of the Arizona Board of Regents. And Eileen, what do you make of these results?
Well, the results certainly are concerning. While we're glad with everything that K-12 has been through with funding challenges and changes in testing and all of the other things going on in K-12, that the numbers didn't go down, for the future, the numbers are a concern when you consider that today we just simply don't have enough students coming out of K-12 to even replace the number of adults with bachelor's degrees today in the workforce.
So do you consider these results in some way an indictment of Arizona's school system?
No, not at all. I think the results show that we have more work to be done. When you look at our state, we have schools large and small all around the state and communities everywhere who demonstrate time and again they have what it takes to get students ready to go to college and to get them through college. But what we don't have is enough consistency statewide in performance, and we don't have yet enough students who demonstrate they're able to do college-level work. The reason, of course, we're worried about that is because the freshman class that starts today is going to graduate into a workforce that requires post-secondary education credentials. So we want to be sure that our students are prepared with the skills that they need to be able to get those credentials and be successful in the workforce.
Enrollment at the state's 3 universities keeps going up. So presumably, if these are not Arizona residents, they're out-of-state students who are taking some of these extra slots?
Right. We have record numbers of freshmen, and unfortunately, we don't have record numbers of Arizona freshmen, and that's certainly a goal here. We want our seats to be filled first by all of our Arizona students who are able to go on to college here. And we see time and again that they're able to do the work. So the question for us is, how can we work more closely with K-12 to make sure that first and foremost, we're all setting aspirations for students to go on and get an education beyond high school, that they're offering the courses that students need so that they can go on to 2-year and 4-year degree opportunities or go into other vocational pursuits or even the military. And then we also need to look closely at our own admission requirements. We want to make sure that we're capturing all the different innovations in K-12 where students can get prepared and recognize those types of courses on our transcripts. So for instance, just this spring, we began accepting a lot of career and technical education courses that show that they're equally able to prepare students the same way that traditional coursework does. So we want to be sure that we're working closely in partnership with K-12, with the teachers that we're preparing so that students have the opportunities. We know the students are able to do the work. The question is, do they have the resources in the schools that they're going to be able to accomplish what they need to be able to go on to college?
The numbers for this in this report were roughly the same as when they were done in 2009. Does that tell you that something really needs to change here if things haven't improved over the last 5 or 6 years already?
Certainly, and it starts with an intense focus on college going. At the next Board of Regents meeting, we'll be taking up a new strategic plan. It's going to be revised, and it will sincerely focus very intentionally on the attainment rate of the number of students going on to college in the state of Arizona, not necessarily public universities, but just statewide, to begin to form a group that's going to be very focused with K-12 leaders, community college leaders, and our private sector college leaders to really focus on creating a college-going culture in Arizona. It's essential for students to go on to get education beyond high school. And together, I think we'll be really effective in setting those aspirations for our young people today.
Eileen Klein is the president of the Arizona Board of Regents. Eileen, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Earlier this month, the Obama administration unveiled its college scorecard. Unlike U.S. News and World Report or Princeton Review, it's not a ranking system, but it does offer a lot of information on colleges and universities across the country, including student debt data and the cost of attending. Kelly Field, senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, has been reporting on the scorecard. Kelly, how long has this been in the works?
The administration has been working on this college scorecard for a couple of years now. Originally, they conceived it as a college rating plan, and they backed off that a little bit under great pressure from colleges. Basically, they feel that students need to have better information about the costs and outcomes of colleges. And originally, they wanted to hold colleges accountable as well by tying some federal money to this, but they backed off that part.
Can you explain some of the metrics? Are there any special algorithms involved, or is it just here's the information, here are different categories to find it?
Well, a lot of the information is limited to students who received federal aid. So that's one nuance there. Another factor is that the earnings data are by institution. So you can't find out what someone who is majoring in biology will make, for example. And often there are considerable differences in earnings by major. So that's a pretty substantial gap there. And future versions are supposed to have program by program breakdowns. But right now you can just find out how the whole institution does.
Does it still add something to the current environment?
It does, because until now, you really haven't been able to find such robust earnings information. I mean, even though it is at the institutional level, most of the earnings information that students have been able to find to date have been based on surveys or have been state-specific. This is the only national data that we have. And so there, it does add something to the college search there. And also on the repayment rates, that's a new piece of information that families would probably find useful as well. Before this, you could just find out how many students defaulted, but that's pretty subject to manipulation by schools and servicers. And so this, you know, repayment rate is a truer rate of how many students are able to repay their student loans.
How do those traditional college rankers, whether it's U.S. News or others, feel about this? Have they expressed anything publicly as we were leading up to its unveiling?
Well, some of the competitors, you know, pointed out these data limitations I was talking about. At colleges, everybody hates U.S. News and World Report, yet they still, you know, feel the need to accommodate it, because a lot of it is based on reputation, and that's always been the criticism of that particular rating. But it remains probably the most popular among consumers. So they're going to get a little competition, and maybe more students will start using this site. It does seem that the number of hits that they've gotten just in the first couple of days, or as many as they got in the last year with the old version of this.
Do you anticipate this affecting how colleges go about what they do, as they know the potential students are going to have more information? Might they change certain approach to something?
Well, it does create an incentive for them to focus on improving in the areas where they're lacking. If they find that the biggest concern that colleges have, I think, is that this information will be picked up by, you know, third parties and included on other sort of ratings. This is just it's not a rating system right now, but you could easily use it to make a rating system. And if those rating systems become popular with consumers and they reflect badly on colleges, they're going to be under some pressure to improve on whatever outcomes that they're doing poorly on.
Kelly, finally, in about 16 months, we'll have a different president and a different, obviously, Department of Education. Is this something that has become nonpartisan? Could it be bipartisan? Is this something that a potential Republican administration might like as well?
I think they would. I mean, Republicans really opposed the idea of having a federal rating system with financial consequences tied to it. But they have always been strongly in favor of more transparency. And so I think that this is something that both parties can embrace, and I don't think it would be anything that would be overturned in a Republican administration if we do get a Republican president.
Kelly Field is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Kelly, thank you.
Thank you.
This week, the State Board of Education voted to authorize two new lawsuits against Arizona School Superintendent Diane Douglas. That follows months of conflict between the two parties, including a call to DPS. But is Arizona unique in its state education setup? For answers, we turn to Jeremy Anderson, president of the Education Commission of the States, a nonpartisan education group.
There's a lot of different setups in multiple states, but a setup where you have an elected chief state school officer and an appointed state board of education. There are nine other states that have that. And of those nine, in five of those states, including Arizona, the chief state school officer is also a voting member of the state board of education. We're seeing in states where the chief state school officer is an elected official, more and more of the governors setting up their own secretary of education. And while it's not really someone who has the power of the Department of Education, it becomes kind of the governor's surrogate or liaison to really push the governor's initiative on some of the education issues. There are a lot of states where the elected chief and the governor's secretary are working in tandem. There are just as many where they are at odds on many of the issues.
In those other states, have they faced the kinds of conflict that Arizona now finds itself dealing with?
You know, they have, and a lot of times it depends on the issue, and it depends on, you know, the leadership style that's going on. I mean, California is one of those states which has had some differences of opinion between an appointed board and an elected chief throughout their history. And there's other states like Montana and North Carolina and even Oklahoma where that has played a part. I can tell you, though, the differences of opinion that are sometimes very visual and able to be seen easily by the public in those setups are just as evident at times if you have a chief that's appointed by a governor and a state board that's elected, or even sometimes a state board that's appointed and a chief that's appointed. The issue in the leadership style usually matters almost as much as how someone arrived at that position.
In the other states that have set up similar to Arizona, how have their conflicts been resolved?
It depends on where you're at. I mean, there are a host of states. Indiana is one of the states that has an elected chief, and the governor appoints the board. And they have had, if you look at the news, a lot of differences of opinion over the last few years, to the point that the chief state school officer had talked about running against the governor and now has backed down from that. But the governor had even taken action to try to set up his own Department of Education outside of what the chief state school officer had. In the end, in most of these states, though, it's the opportunity to find the collaboration around the issue that really brings everybody back to the focus of what their jobs are, which is really looking at the state education system and what are the outcomes that are desired by the people.
Do these conflicts tend to affect what happens inside the classroom?
I think it depends on the state. A lot of these discussions that are going on at the state board level and with the chief state school officer are about school finance and state funding, sometimes around standards. But when you get down into the classroom, those are choices that are made in many cases by local school boards. Local school boards who are making choices around curriculum and around some of the other changes that would take place in their individual schools. So I think it's 50 one way, 50 the other, as to say, you know, the conflict at a state level is really creating a problem in the classroom.
Have there been states that have had a setup one way, either with everybody appointed or somebody elected and some people appointed, that have changed those setups to go in a different direction?
Yeah, there are. Since 1975, 14 states have really passed different kinds of legislation, some even constitutional amendments in their state, to really look at giving the governor additional power, whether that's in appointing the chief or appointing the state board, depending on the state you're in.
Jeremy Anderson is president of the Education Commission of the States. Jeremy, thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mark.
Coming up on the show, the Phoenix Police Department wants to use a budget surplus to add to their ranks, but not everyone thinks more cops are the answer.
Proposition 104 was meant to add more transportation, and so we're very disappointed that this is now being used to bring more officers on the force.
That and more just ahead on the show. Good afternoon to your Valley Freeways. Accidents I-10 westbound at 51st Avenue, that's restricting the off-ramp. There's also a collision on the 60 westbound at I-10. And I-17 southbound at New River. That collision could be causing some backup there. Valley weather for the rest of today will stay sunny, looking for a high of 98. And clear skies in the forecast for tonight with lows in the mid to upper 70s. Currently, relative humidity is at 23%. We have blue skies, 93 degrees at KJZZ at 224.
KJZZ is supported by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Phoenix, where patient-empowered care means your treatment team meets with you at one time, in one room, for every appointment to answer your questions. CancerCenter.com.
The U.S. military manages about 30 million acres of land across the country, 2 million of which is in Arizona. That can be a problem when much of that is critical habitat for rare species. But as KJZZ's Will Stone reports, environmentalists see this as an opportunity.
Clear.
A bombing range may seem like the last place to find pockets of undisturbed ecosystems. But take a flight around the Barry M. Goldwater Range, west of Phoenix, and you'd be hard-pressed to find scorched earth.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's one of the best places for habitat for Sonora Desert species.
Ian Dowdy is riding in a small prop airplane. Below, the valley stretches across wrinkled mountains into farmland, finally giving way to a succession of subdivisions. Dowdy is a fan of what the military does here.
They only operate and use impact about 5% of this entire ground. So they have some certain target areas that are identified and that they use for their training, but the rest of it remains wild and open and available for wildlife.
That link between the environment and military is what Dowdy's organization, the Sonoran Institute, hopes to leverage. It's spearheading a plan that would restrict development on pieces of public land around the range, mostly by designating them as federal conservation areas. Dowdy says if you compare the flight corridors for jets to those used by wildlife on the ground.
The lines are very similar. We see a mutual benefit here between protecting the landscape under the military overflight areas and protecting the landscape for wildlife to connect from one place to another.
The danger, especially in a place of rapid growth like Arizona, is that development springs up around military installations, eventually hampering training operations. That's not just a national security issue, it's an economic one. The military generates about $9 billion a year for Arizona's economy.
The more acres you have, the more flexibility you have to change your mission.
Fred Pease is a retired Air Force official who oversaw the management of ranges throughout the U.S. About 400 threatened and endangered species are found on Department of Defense land, from the Okaloosa darterfish in Florida to the western snowy plover in Southern California. The reason? Wildlife take refuge in the best remaining habitat. And this dynamic has led Pease to once ask,
at what point does this thing become a wildlife refuge and no longer adequate for training and readiness?
Maintaining open habitat around bases and ranges, he says, could ease that burden.
Conservation folks are realizing that, hey, you know, some of these military lands are really great, but we shouldn't put all the pressure on them.
But in an era when public land is an increasingly contentious issue in the West, the proposed legislation behind this plan, introduced by Democratic Congressman Raul Grijalva, faces an uphill battle. Republican Congressman Paul Gosar represents much of western Arizona, and his district borders the Goldwater Range.
Now, when we go to the Sonoran Desert, we're going to find a lot of obstinance right there. And the reason being is the federal government can't take care of its own lands.
Both of Arizona's senators expressed similar reluctance about the legislation. Gosar says there are already tools for managing environmental issues on military land, and he won't support any new regulatory hurdles, which could impact mining and other economic interests.
There's not going to be any new designations other than maybe presidential, and then they'll get a fight on it.
The congressman is referring to a national monument designation. That's how about 500,000 acres on the range was set aside in 2001 by President Bill Clinton. It's now the Sonoran Desert National Monument. Back on the plane, conservationist Ian Dowdy points to a piece of unprotected habitat between the Estrella Mountains and the monument. A freeway is slated to go there, he says.
What we tried to do is put together a plan that would allow something like a freeway to pass through here while maintaining the wildlife connectivity.
That's not the case for all the land. Some would be wilderness and allow for very little human activity, save for fighter jets flying overhead. For Dowdy, these are the trade-offs that make up a realistic conservation plan in a place such as Arizona. Will Stone, KJZZ News, reporting from the Barry Goldwater Range.
Think you've got what it takes to sing the national anthem at a Phoenix Suns game? Well, then it's time to step up to the mic and belt it out. KJZZ's Phil Latzman took the challenge and fell flat in the Valley's version of America's Got Talent.
If this were one of those TV talent competitions, Kip Helt would be the chief judge.
Basically, three things that I always look at is one is singing in tune, two is knowing the words, and we'd like you to be able to execute the song and sing it in 90 seconds or less.
Helt is the team's PA announcer and is also vice president of game entertainment for the Suns, a job he's had for more than 15 years. He's seen thousands of hopeful performers and says you never know who might show up, including some future stars.
I'll never forget a young lady by the name of Jordan Sparks coming in to audition 1 year. And she sang, and she still sings for us, but her first time singing for us was when she was 11 years old.
And what so proudly we
Helt watches and listens as about 100 people showed up on Monday to perform, and some of them to mangle, the Star Spangled Banner in the lobby of the U.S. Airways Center. 14-year-old Summer Welsh is one of those hopefuls.
It'd be a great opportunity to be able to sing in front of a lot of people, especially at a Suns game, so I thought it'd be cool to try out.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light?
Resembling Joan Baez, Hava Cannon showed up with guitar in hand.
What so proudly we hail at the twilight's last gleaming.
13-year-old Cameron Gooch capably handles the tenor sax, explaining,
there's a lot of vocalists these days, so why not just try the instrument?
However, not everyone is ready for prime time.
Whose bright stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight that, okay, I forgot the words.
And then, hold your ears, it was my turn.
O'er the ramparts we'd watched were so gallantly streaming.
So much for that. And time for the pros to take over, like Kevin Gallagher.
And the rockets' red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there.
And to take us out, here's Lauren Anderson.
Say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave?
And if it sounds like the last two have done this before, they have. Anderson is a freelance musician, and Gallagher is a former high school music teacher. He admits he's been at this for quite some time.
I started with the Suns when they were at the Madhouse in McDowell at the State Fairgrounds, the Coliseum, and then moved over here when America West Arena was built.
In 1992. So, with a voice like that, why hasn't the 51-year-old Gallagher tried out for one of those TV talent shows? Well, as it turns out, he has.
The American Idol is... they got an age limit, and I'm a little bit over the age limit. I like The Voice, and I went and auditioned with them this past summer.
How'd you do?
I can't say.
So stay tuned and try to stay in tune, unlike me.
Of the brave.
In Phoenix, Phil Latzman, AJZZ News.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Mirna Pacheco. We are in Learning Possibilities.
Come on in, guys.
I've been training dogs for over 10 years.
Let's go. Pick up a face. And down.
Weaver, come here.
Sit.
Stay.
People get cute puppies, and then they bring them home, and what then? And then the puppy chews, pees everywhere, do all kind of crazy stuff, and then they get like, okay, help.
Good job, guys.
My name is Rob. I'm here with Lisa, and we have Odin and Ollie with us.
Their newest thing is chewing throw pillows, and it looks like it snowed in my house when I get home.
You have yet to get to all the shoes. We look forward to going to a park and not having them on a leash and calling them to come back and knowing that they're going to respond, and we are definitely making progress.
That's Mirna Pacheco leading a dog training class along with Elisa Denneke and Rob Salaya training their puppies. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to use one of those dog whistles on us, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Still to come, you're fired. Okay, you're not. But who is?
How is Donald Trump going to fire Rudy Giuliani? Come on, that's a pretty obvious one right there.
The bigger question was, how is he going to fire Victoria Gotti?
The quiz show is just ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic on I-10 westbound, the exit ramp at 51st Avenue is restricted. Elsewhere, 60 westbound, an accident at I-10, and the 101 northbound in the East Valley, an accident at Chaparral. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 98 degrees. That was yesterday's high as well. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-70s. Sunny skies tomorrow and right on through the weekend with highs right around 100 or 101 each day. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 23%, sunny and 93 degrees at 236.
KJZZ is supported by Hotel Del Coronado. Connecting happens the moment you choose to disconnect. With white sand beaches, San Diego weather, and personalized service and experiences. Reservations at HotelDel.com. Connect today.
Good afternoon. In a check of the news from KJZZ, the U.S. Justice Department today announced a proposed $940 million landmark settlement with Native American tribes over contract shortfalls. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
This dispute goes back decades. Under the 1975 Indian Self-Determination Act, tribes have local control over services like road maintenance, fire, and police, but the federal government pays for them. It's all spelled out in contracts. But Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs Kevin Washburn says sometimes the appropriations weren't enough.
Some kinks have taken a while to work out. For several years, Congress did not appropriate enough money for all the contract costs that we were required by statute to pay. That sometimes created a gap between what we promised to pay and what we actually paid.
The class action suit includes members from some 500 tribes. They'll review the settlement and decide whether to appeal. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
It's 2:40.
As a result of the passage of Proposition 104, the city of Phoenix finds itself with a $16 million surplus in the general fund. The city's considering using part of that surplus to hire an additional 125 officers for the Phoenix Police Department. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins joins us. Jimmy, why the push for so many cops?
Well, during the financial crisis of 2008, the city implemented a hiring freeze. Back then, the Phoenix Police had more than 3,300 officers, but they've been losing about 100 officers a year to attrition, and now the force stands just shy of 2,700.
So is the goal to get back to those original 2008 numbers?
Actually, they'd like to exceed those numbers. As I reported a year ago, the Phoenix Police Department already had the go-ahead to hire an additional 300 officers, and they'd like to add several hundred more. I spoke with Commander Blake McClellan with the Phoenix Police Department. He's in charge of recruitment, but he says given all the national news of the last year, it's hard to do.
The police are not shown in the best of light across the country, and it becomes increasingly more difficult to recruit a population of officers to engage in this career. So with that, what we have done is we've put together a recruiting team. We have a sergeant and six officers that are dedicated solely to recruiting, and they're getting out in the community. They're going to different meetings. They're working with higher education. They're working with the minority communities and the advisory boards. And they're getting out there, and they're trying to get people to join our ranks because we would like for our police department to mirror the demographics of the community.
What are the current demographics of the Phoenix Police Department?
We are about 75% white, 4% African American, 15% Hispanic, and 2% Asian. And so what we would like to do, and of the people we have hired, we've hired 88 people so far. And of that, 59% are white, 4.5% are African American, 34% are Hispanic, and 2% are Asian. So in the area, and as far as women go, women right now make up 12.7% of the police department. And of the ones we've hired so far, they make up 20%. So we're going in the right direction. It's very difficult to change the overall demographics of the police department with just one or two academy classes. So we have no quotas per se, but we do want to make sure that the demographics of the police department mirror the community and then, of course, mirror what we're hiring.
Once officers are selected, what kind of training do they go through?
When we hire somebody, they don't hit the street immediately. They have to go to a 20-week police academy. And once you graduate from the police academy, you do a 3-week post-academy, which gets you familiar with just the Phoenix requirements. The police academy is a regional academy, so there's officers from all over the state. So the next 3 weeks after you graduate is focused solely on Phoenix policies, procedures, rules, and regulations. And then after that, you go to a 16-week field training program. So you're actually riding with another officer for 16 weeks. It's a one-on-one, on-the-job training. And then after all that's complete, the officer is capable to go solo, but then they still have a one-year probation period from the time they were promoted to police officer.
Some critics of policing say there's too much emphasis in the training on things like firearms and use of force and not enough on communication and de-escalation. Can you explain what kind of training Phoenix officers do receive in those areas?
They are given classes exactly in those topics at the police academy. And, of course, when they get out into the field, they're going to be monitored and evaluated by their field training officers to make sure that they can perform those type of things like de-escalation and communicate and just being able to talk to people. Use of force and shooting, arrest tactics, they're high liability, low frequency type events. And what we want to do is we want to make sure that when those low frequency events do happen, like an officer involved shooting or a fight to arrest somebody, we want to make sure that they're prepared for those as well.
But, Steve, while the Phoenix Police are committed to increasing their personnel numbers, not everyone in the community is convinced that's the best way to spend taxpayer money. Carlos Garcia is the director of Puente, Arizona, a migrant justice organization based in Phoenix.
I don't believe Phoenix is in need or ready to have more police officers. I think the Phoenix Police Department really needs to do some soul searching. It's one of the deadliest police departments in the country, one of the police departments with the most problems regarding racial profiling and abuse towards migrants. And so for us, we would like the police department to first reform itself, to change its ways towards our community before they hire one or two or however many more officers they're going to bring on.
as they do recruit new officers, would you like to see more of the Latino community be among their ranks? Would that help?
I think there's a culture within the Phoenix Police Department. There's a culture within Arizona policing already that is biased towards immigrants, that is biased towards people of color, that needs to be changed. And so whether a person is a Latino or is African-American, it doesn't matter if the culture and the policies of the police department lead to the abuse in our communities.
So instead of hiring more police officers, what would you like specifically for them to do?
Instead of hiring more police officers, I think the Phoenix Police Department needs to focus on training the officers that they have, dealing with the policies that are broken, that are leading to the separation of families or excessive use of force. I think the police department, with the turmoil it's had with the different chiefs and all those sorts of things, needs to really shift and reform itself before they add any other police officers.
Has anyone from the Phoenix Police Department reached out to you as they take on this new recruitment process?
We have not been reached out to as to the new recruitment or hiring of new officers. I think it is crucial that they do so. I think the community involvement and who is going to be policing our communities, especially when we've been abused by this department, it is very important. And so for us, it's kind of been done in an underhanded way. Proposition 104 was meant to add more transportation, add more resources to lower income and communities of color. And now what we see is that the result of this proposition is more cops. And that's not what was meant. That's not what was said. And so we're very disappointed that this is now being used to bring more officers on the force.
That was Carlos Garcia, director of Puente, Arizona. He says if the money is used to hire more police, his group would like the opportunity to work with the Phoenix Police Department to stress the importance of cultural sensitivity.
KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure, Steve.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. The show is a stream of curated stories from Phoenix, our region, and around the country. With the help of reporters and producers across the region and the globe, we mix the stories and news to keep you up to date and entertained.
And in the immediate part of our region, some accidents to watch out for on the Valley freeways. 101 northbound in Scottsdale at Chaparral. Also I-10 westbound at 51st Avenue and the 60 westbound at I-10. We'll stay sunny for the rest of the afternoon. Still looking for a forecast high of 98. And then for tonight, clear skies, lows in the mid to upper 70s. Currently, relative humidity is at 23%. The skies are clear. It's 93 degrees at 2:48.
KJZZ is supported by High Health. Introducing Optum Nutrition Vitra, plant-based protein powder from whole food ingredients. Vitra is free of dairy, gluten, soy, artificial flavors, and sweeteners. Available at High Health stores and highhealth.com.
We're coming to the end of another long, scorching valley summer. But even with that reality, water still comes out of our pipes, and we're not fighting in the streets to claim our fair share. Paolo Bacigalupi's novel, The Water Knife, imagines a not-too-distant future in Phoenix when we may be doing just that, and where the wealthy are getting as much water as they want, while low-income residents are trying to survive by paying $6 a gallon. Paolo, more than a decade ago, I interviewed an international water expert who told me the fight over water in the future would potentially be more intense than the fight over oil has been. Is The Water Knife a sign you think that could be true as well?
Well, I think that, you know, there's water is fundamental. It's everything. It's our industry. It's our life. It's everything. And so, you know, the real question is how low can we go? You know, there is some point where we reach a zero sum set of outcomes. And, you know, one person gets water, another person doesn't. Typically in the Western United States, you already see that in the way that water rights get divvied up. And when you see that there's a drought, senior water rights holders get all the water and the junior water rights holders don't. And if you're junior, you're annoyed. The classic sort of shooting battle over water that I think of is when Los Angeles took the water from the Owens River Valley. And And in that case, you know, people did notice, and they did try to shoot it to Los Angeles for a while, and they did try to blow up the pipelines for a while. And you know, that's that sort of winners and losers scenario. If you have water, your life is relatively stable. And I think about something like the Middle East and Syria, things like that, where, you know, one interpretation of the entire Syrian revolution is essentially that it was triggered by drought, because drought moved refugees into the cities, which triggered unrest, which then triggered a revolution. It's not a fight over water per se, but it's a fight because of water scarcity.
We have the vision of a Phoenix as a place that grew because water finally came, and in the water knife, and then maybe in reality as well, maybe the water's not going to be as readily available. What's the reaction both at the real level and also the fictional level? And where do those intersect in terms of what the reaction would be of not only the public, but how our government leaders and others should react to that?
I had one person on Twitter like flaming at me, saying like that that Phoenix actually is in a lush desert, quote unquote, and things would be fine. So that person clearly didn't think that the interpretation was at all reasonable. On the other hand, I was talking to a state rep down there and talking about the different ways that groundwater gets managed and how pumping is either controlled or not controlled in, you know, different parts of the basin. And he was kind of pessimistic about how prepared Phoenix was to deal with real scarcity. The thing that really stands out to me the most is that places like Phoenix or Las Vegas or most Western U.S. cities are all built on top of an immense amount of engineering expertise. We figured out how to store water. We figured out how to move water. We managed to make places lush that were not lush before. And we expanded to the edge of that capacity. When we sort of move past the point where we can engineer a solution, what happens? And that's what the water knife is about. It's about a scarcity situation where we don't have any more engineering solves and we have to face the absolute scarcity.
No doubt you've heard the word dystopian attached to the water knife. First of all, how does that term apply, do you think, in this case, or does it not? And can we consider that the future you describe in the water knife is pretty bleak?
It's definitely bleak. I think of myself, so dystopian futures in my mind are futures that were deliberate. You know, they're supposed to be the perfect place that turns out to be hellish. You know, George Orwell's 1984 or Aldous Huxley's Brave New World or, you know, Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, things like that, which are, you know, these deliberately designed spaces that are perfected and yet horrific. You know, I tend to think of myself as writing accidental futures, the future that we sort of tripped and fell into and didn't really want. And so people will often call the book dystopian, but I think of it as more, an accidental future, an unintended future. And they are bleak. They're the world we didn't want. They're the one that we sort of look up after we get there and say, wait a second, I want to take that last exit, you know, that was 20 miles back, not this one.
And an unintended future because our eyes weren't open, or unintended future because people thought, yeah, we could figure it out at some point.
Yeah, accidental. Essentially that we sort of went tripping along, assuming that everything was fine, and then sort of suddenly realized, it mattered. You know, the climate change mattered. We should have been making ourselves more resilient a long time ago. We should have actually been cutting back on our water use a long time ago. We should have been planning, we should have stopped building subdivisions because we weren't going to be able to support them. You know, the data was there. And this is the thing I'm always fascinated by, is we have an immense amount of information available to us about where we're headed. We have an immense amount of data available to us that tells us climate change is real, it's here, it's going to have significant effects. We can sort of already see some of those effects on the ground, but we can also understand from the data what the general effects will be in the future. We could plan right now. These futures that I write tend to be the ones where people say, we'll get to that sometime, and then it's too late.
Novelist Paolo Bacigalupi, author of The Water Knife. He's in the Valley tonight for a lecture at ASU called The Imagination Drought, Speculative Fiction as a Tool of Warning and Empowerment.
And now it's time for The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back Leszek Pawlowicz, our resident quizmaster who's won a Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions. Each time he's on, he'll play one of us in a game of trivia hosted by our producer, Sarah Ventry. This week, he's playing KJZZ host Phil Latzman,
who won't be singing the national anthem. Last week, we gave you a puzzle to solve and randomly selected two correct entries. The puzzle was, the day after tomorrow will be 3 days before Tuesday. What day is today? The answer is Thursday.
It actually is. today.
Perfect, I know. Our randomly selected winners this week are Kenneth Berger and Brian Verbal. Leshek will play on behalf of Kenneth, Phil will play on behalf of Brian, and whoever wins will get a special KJZZ item.
Leshek, the first question goes to you. The first ever Disney character got its own Instagram account. Which Disney star is it? Is it Cinderella, Elsa, or Minnie Mouse?
Instagram account. Wow. I'm going to say Cinderella.
It's actually Minnie Mouse.
It's Minnie Mouse.
I was going to say Minnie Mouse. I don't want to just because I think that's the oldest Disney character, like Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse. So
yeah.
That was why I thought.
But I actually would think the older characters didn't have them. Like, they're not as hip to things as, like, the newer ones, right?
Maybe.
Okay. Phil.
Yes.
Keurig, the company that makes instant coffee makers and associated coffee products, has recently announced a collaboration with what brand? Is it Kraft to make mac and cheese K-cups? Is it Campbell's to make soup K-cups? Mm. Or is it Hormel to make chili K-cups?
Wow. Just because of the process involved there, I'm going to go with the mac and cheese K-cups because that seems like it would be easier to produce.
You know what? It's Campbell's.
Oh. Yep. They're making soup.
They're making soup.
I guess that sort of makes sense, too.
I'm a little
skeptical.
Chili
wouldn't taste very good from a K-cup, I don't think.
We'll have to find out how the soup is. But I'm for anything that involves, like, on-demand mac and cheese. So I am a little disappointed. All right, Leshek. French scientists are planning to wake up a 30,000-year-old giant virus to try and make sure that it's not harmful to humans. The virus was found underground where? Was it Siberia, Mongolia, or Ukraine?
I've read about this one. It was found in the permafrost in Siberia.
It was found in the permafrost in Siberia.
Wow, pressure's on now.
All right, Phil. Part of a skeleton from an early human ancestor called Homo naledi was recently found in which country? Was it Ethiopia, Kenya, or South Africa?
Ooh, boy. I think I heard this on NPR, but
oh, no.
I'm not sure of the location. I'm going to guess somewhere in Africa. And I'll go with Kenya?
No.
Oh, my God.
I read about it this morning, too. It's South Africa.
Oh, well, I had the continent correct.
All right, Leshek, reality television.
Oh,
my favorite subject. Donald Trump has been in the news a lot lately, but let's talk about my favorite thing that he's done, Celebrity Apprentice. Which of the following people was not a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice? Was it Rod Blagojevich, Victoria Gotti, or Rudy Giuliani?
I am going to say Rudy Giuliani.
You are right.
Yeah. Oh, how is Donald Trump going to fire Rudy Giuliani? Come on, that's a pretty obvious one right there.
The bigger question was, how was he going to fire Victoria Gotti? Because a lot of people got really scared when she was on their team. Who knows what
might
would
be
happen.
A mob hit or something.
There might be a something. Leshek got two right.
So I guess it's all over? I mean, no. I can't even compete here for the last
question? No. You know, you can absolutely. You got the first one. Didn't you get the first one right?
No, I did not.
Oh.
I'm scoreless.
All right, Leshek, that means you are still the reigning champ.
Oh.
The newsroom will have some more time to stew over who's
going
to take you on next.
I want a rematch.
Anytime, Phil.
We'll keep bringing Leshek back, so stay tuned for the next listener puzzle and your chance to be one of our at-home players.
Make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 for the show, preservation efforts at Taliesin West, and how Arizona stacks up in the number of electric cars on the road. Those stories and a whole lot more tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
And if you've got some time tonight, well, you might want to check out the Phoenix Mercury hosting the Tulsa Shock. That's at 7 o'clock at U.S. Airways Center.
You can also check out the musical Chicago Tonight. That's at Phoenix Theater.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Rebozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. The news director is Al Macias. Executive producer is John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have some good story ideas. You can reach us at theshow@kjzz.org. Also, make sure to download the KJZZ mobile app. It's free. You can podcast us. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Thanks so much for listening. It's 3 o'clock.